Marika Warren, network ethicist for the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, and I'll be facilitating this discussion about experiences addressing the ethical issues arising during the COVID-19 pandemic. With me today, I have three Canadian healthcare ethicists who have generously agreed to share their experiences. So I'll have each of you introduce yourselves, starting in the East.
Hi, I'm Chris Capozzi. I'm a healthcare ethicist with the Provincial Health Ethics Network of Newfoundland and Labrador, and also associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine at Memorial University.
And Diane?
Hello, I'm Diane Godkin. I'm the senior ethicist at Trillium Health Partners in Mississauga, Ontario.
And Duncan?
Hi, I'm Duncan Steele. I'm the senior consultant for organizational ethics with Alberta Health Services. And during the ongoing COVID response, I've been sitting virtually in the command center of the ECC for Alberta. And I sit within Calgary, Alberta.
Excellent. Well, thank you all so much. And to start off, I'll ask each of you to give us a brief snapshot of the surprising, particular, or unique experiences that you've had addressing ethical issues during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. So Chris, maybe we'll start with you.
Okay, thanks, Marika. So, during COVID-19 pandemic, it's been a number of challenges. Some of the great things that we've been able to do in our province have been the support that we provided to clinical teams and executive teams around development of policy and around cases and things like that. So we have a very robust ethics network. And we're able to help out very, very quickly developing documents and things like that for pretty complex issues. Some of the challenges that we've encountered, there's a number. Yeah, I could go on forever, I'm sure, about this. But one of them is that, interestingly, the non-COVID cases continued to crop up even while we had this increased workload dealing with COVID issues. Notably things in psychiatry seem to, we dealt with a number of cases in that area over the past few months. Major challenge that I encountered personally was just the amount of stress and moral distress dealing with some of these issues, participating in developing a triage protocol for critical care. Hugely stressful, not something I'd ever experienced in even the most sort of complex life and death case. During the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, we similarly developed a protocol that we had to update. But for some reason at that time, I didn't experience the same kind of stress, same kind of physical symptoms of stress. I don't know why. I think part of it had to do with the fact that this time around we were developing it virtually, teleconference, video conference, and you don't have the same kind of just basic human interaction that can sustain you through really stressful experiences when you're trying to work together in that way. So that's the main challenge that sort of stands out for me during the first wave of this pandemic.
Terrific. And for you, Diane?
Thanks, Marika. Just to give you a little bit of a context around what's been happening at the organization I work at, we are a large academic community hospital with over 1,300 beds and 10,000 staff and volunteers. And our region was one of the hardest hit by COVID-19 in Ontario. We've cared for a number of COVID-19 positive patients in our hospital and intensive care units, and are now also managing the care in an adjacent long-term care facility that lost many of its residents to COVID-19. In addition to having a leadership role in our hospital's pandemic governance structure, I have also been a member of the Ontario Bioethics Table that was established to provide advice and recommendations for Ontario Health. As well, I've participated in a number of several Ontario Health pandemic response committees. So who knew when we were celebrating the arrival of 2020 what a year it would be? When asked to reflect on what was surprising, particular, or unique about the ethical issues encountered during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, three issues came to mind. First was the amplification of issues related to long-standing and known existing inequities in healthcare, such as long-term care home staffing concerns, poverty, and crowded housing. People in all of these settings were disproportionately diagnosed with COVID-19 and tended to have poorer outcomes. It appears that these inequities are being surfaced in a way that has resonated with the public differently and more intensely than I ever recall happening before. And at our hospital, we have begun to identify and tackle equity issues in a much more intentional and coordinated way. And I'm hopeful that one of the silver linings of this pandemic will be some real and long-lasting change that will result in better health outcomes for those who have been historically disadvantaged. Second, I was refreshingly surprised about how open and committed Ontario Health and the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care were to engaging the ethics community around thorny issues, from drug shortages to critical care triage to PPE, to visitor guidance, to testing centers, to approaches to ramping services up and down. Most of the briefs and guidance documents produced by Ontario Health have incorporated an ethical framework with guiding principles to ground and guide decision-making processes. Third, I have been a bit disheartened that certain pandemic measures that were implemented or proposed with the intent of saving lives, such as restricting the number of people who could gather at a time, wearing masks in public spaces, developing critical care triage protocols to fairly allocate scarce resources, and limiting visitors to healthcare institutions became framed as individual rights issues. And I've been surprised at how strident some have been in lobbying for those rights, from protest marches to letter writing campaigns, etc. And from my perspective, the principle of solidarity has never been more important and continues to be something I'm working hard to promote. So I look forward to the discussion with Duncan and Chris on their experiences in other parts of the country.
So similar to Diane, maybe it's worthwhile explaining a bit of how we structured our response. So in Alberta, we also were a singular health authority. There's also a Catholic system attached as well. And both of them, both of us have a singular united ethics services of about, say, I'll say 15 or 18 folks. And what we did early on when the emergency was first called is basically set up two structures. And one was a clinical rapid response team, a hotline 24/7 that was for acting as a central intake, really trying to ensure consistency and quality of how we were responding at a clinical level as clinical consults were coming up. Similar to what Chris was saying, as we were receiving, still receiving at that time, especially normal consults, our kind of day-to-day clinical level stuff, but now we're receiving a lot more COVID-related ones. And most of those, as we found, were also related to organizational issues. And so we also broke a second or had a second structure that was mainly me or kind of that I was the coordinator for, sitting within the ECC, the Emergency Coordination Center, and in a basically a reporting matrix where I was reporting to my boss, my executive director, and as well as the directors and deputy directors within the ECC. And I was acting or in that role was acting as a conduit between the ECC so I could bring stuff as we were hearing issues coming up at the bedside and at a clinical level, I could bring that up into leadership and onto their radar to make sure that it was being noticed and being acted on. And then also could act as a conduit down to our clinical ethics team to make sure that, again, they knew the kind of things that were being tackled and could also identify if there were issues that they were hearing about and they wanted to have a voice in or bring some perspective onto to bear, that they could do that and jump onto those decision-making teams and that sort of thing. And again, I'll just emphasize that what we were really trying to do is be very quick to respond and make sure that there was consistency and quality in how we were responding because there was so much, as I'm sure you can all relate, so much new information coming up every day and changing information as well, and lots of ambiguity and uncertainties early on in the pandemic. In terms of things that were surprising, or actually I'll start with things that were not surprising, is that at an organizational level, we spent a significant amount of time early on working with teams around triage protocols for adult NICU, pediatric populations, but also with PPE, as you might imagine, around kind of prioritization and distribution planning. Interesting pieces, though, that we couldn't have predicted at that organizational level early on is that we would be asked questions around, in terms of PPE, the ethics of reprocessing N95 respirators, which wasn't something that any of us had experienced from prior pandemics with H1N1 or even looking back further to SARS in the early 2000s. Others were questions like understanding the precautionary principle. So within the PPE task force, one of the things they wanted to know was kind of to get coached a bit or a bit of a starter on how to understand the precautionary principle, because it was being brought up in our province and across Canada by I'll say various labor groups with an interest in making sure that their healthcare workers were protected. And so this team wanted to know more about how to make sense of that. And in terms of things that at a clinical level, in a day-to-day, we can look at our data and kind of roughly predict that we're going to have, say, about 25% or 20% of those consults being around the theme of consent and capacity. There tends to be kind of fairly well-trodden pathways of types of clinical consults we get. But there were things that came up with COVID that were quite surprising. So there were stretches where it seemed like all of our clinical ethicists were being touched on and working on consults to do with smoking, related to smoking. And that was a really big one. So it boiled down to kind of around freedoms and constraints of patients, movement of patients, as well as interactions with visitors, respect for autonomy, understandings of substance use and addictions. And it touched on many different things where we were reviewing policies that had to do with this and it had to do with exceptions, where we were having conversations with decision-making groups to try and help frame the conversation for them and help to understand how to make sense of these fairly tricky issues. And writing ethics briefs and talking about how to set up the isolation hotels for supporting people who wanted to isolate but didn't have the means and these sorts of things. So that in particular was one that came up that really surprised us, as well as others. And as well, looking forward to the discussion with all of you.
So thank you all for that really rich range of experiences that we've got on the table now. So I'm wondering, what about the other panelists' experiences particularly resonated with each of you? And maybe we'll go in reverse order this time. So maybe start with you, Duncan, and then go back to you, to Chris.
Sure. Thanks so much, Marika. So one of the things that that caught my attention was, Chris, you were mentioning that a surprise, or that something that really resonated for you, was the amount of stress and moral distress in dealing with the issues, and both from kind of a personal level and with the other ethicists, but also in the teams and the individuals you're supporting. That's something that's also come up in the Alberta context, of course, not surprising at all, and that we're working on a bit currently in developing some ideas about how to support both ourselves and teams in the context of moral distress of these very difficult decisions, sometimes around very, very, potentially very, very hard prioritization decisions or resource allocation decisions. I wonder if you could tell me a bit more about your experience and anything that you've developed in your approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose unlike Alberta, we haven't really developed a lot of measures or supports for moral distress. But the issue wasn't really in the forefront a lot of the time, but you knew it was in the background, because we'd have meetings with senior members of the executive talking about, you know, the triage protocol, and they'd say things like, "Yeah, I wasn't able to sleep last night because I was thinking about this," and everybody on the call would know what that was like, because they were feeling the same thing, I think. And just the feeling of, you know, walking around all day with a knot in your chest and looking at the numbers go up every day and wondering when this thing was going to be used. So it was kind of in the background. It hasn't come up directly as an issue for developing supports, though I think that's a really great idea, and I'd like to see what you guys are doing.
We had just to build on that, is we had that same kind of thinking going on, just the realization that, like I was saying, that especially with those triage documents, triage protocols early on, and the kind of looming wave, and the expectation that things were going to get very, very bleak. We can relate to that. I can relate to that, and the lost sleep as well, and the worries about how are we going to then, if we actually have to actuate these or activate these protocols, how are we as an ethics team going to support the folks who are making these very difficult decisions, the families and patients who are going to be impacted by these very difficult decisions? Yeah. So that was, I don't know, Diane, if you wanted to build on that at all. I have another question that I'd like to ask you, if I may.
Sure. And I will just comment a little bit about that, because I think one of the things that we incorporated into our structure at our local hospital was a whole arm of our command table is about resilience and really trying to take care of our staff, take care of each other. And I know personally for myself, I'm still dreaming. I wake up and I'm dreaming something about COVID-19. Well, what are we going to do about this? Or how are we going to manage that? So it's, even though it's, I don't feel stressed in the moment necessarily, you know, it's on your mind and subconsciously it's, you're working through these different issues. And certainly critical care triage has been, our provincial tool really has not landed yet. We're still doing a great deal of work and working with a lot of community organizations, disability groups, et cetera, to try to make sure that the document is well understood and is not, there's a real concern that it would, you know, further disadvantage folks that have already been disadvantaged in other ways. So it's been a great deal of work continuing on that. And thank goodness we didn't have to implement it in the way that we thought we might. And I'm hopeful that we've learned enough from the first wave that we won't have to implement it in a second wave either, that we can manage our capacity in a way that will preclude. But there's an uncertainty there. And I think that's what makes everybody nervous, that it seems to change so fast. One outbreak becomes two outbreaks, becomes three outbreaks, and then you're out of control. And just watching, I think that's been a very interesting thing, watching around the world what's happening in different countries at different times, or even across the country in different provinces, and how it spikes up and then it seems to settle. And so there's as much modeling that's been done. It's not, it's not 100% predictive of where we're going to be. Yeah, so I can definitely empathize with the moral distress and stress, just general stress that involved in all of this.
Yeah. I thought that a really interesting thing you brought up, Diane, and I didn't write a proper note here for myself to reference it, but was around how the coronavirus has really kind of exposed and brought to light or shone a light on some of the really kind of structural systemic inequities in our society, in our different provinces, and within, I think, in ways that we see, especially in the health system, but we also see in the social system and more broadly. Did you want to add more to that? I have some thoughts on that as well.
I mean, there's lots that could be said, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I think we're still at the beginning in terms of how to actually address some of these issues and how to make those changes, because they're not just healthcare issues. They are very much social issues, predominantly social issues, but they have an impact on health. So poverty, housing, all of those things that I think we knew about and we knew they were there, but somehow just it just feels different this time to me, that there's a more of a sincerity at all sort of government levels and within organizations that we actually have to do something about this now, or we're going to be even in worse trouble when the next pandemic hits. So I don't have too much else to say about that, but I look forward to other comments you might have.
Yeah, I thought it was a really insightful point. And we see it, or I see it in Alberta and across Canada in the ways, well, I'll just speak to the Alberta context. So in the isolation hotels, so thinking about how do we support people who are homeless or don't have places to shelter, but want to shelter and want to self-isolate because they have they're symptomatic or because they've had a positive test. And so that was one of the places where the piece around homelessness or housing came up a lot. And we did quite a bit of work around that. And also, I think what you're saying also, it underscores that kind of the dynamics of power within society, and where we see on a day-to-day as ethics services, I think we see at clinical levels and organizational levels a lot, those differences in power coming out or bearing their heads out. And we saw that even more within the pandemic, where we would have to, and I think Alberta, in a lot of ways, I'm really proud of the responses of the different levels of leadership who've been involved, being very concerned about people who were homeless or using and accessing shelters, at being a very at-risk population, and how to make sure that they were being treated respectfully and tested in ways, or being given the opportunity to test in ways that respected their autonomy and tried to be truly informed about consent and what the consequences of a positive test might look like, such as an isolation hotel and not being at the shelter anymore and having some restrictions on freedom and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to underscore that I think that there were some very interesting pieces, such as that one around housing and homelessness, that came up. Chris, did you want to add anything from your perspective in the Maritimes?
We did have that issue of homelessness and potential housing issues and isolation and figuring out ways to house people who wanted to isolate, and also the issue of, you know, potentially coercive isolation of people with housing issues. And fortunately, I mean, there wasn't really an outbreak with those sort of hard to reach populations so far anyway, but it's something that's still on the go. And it's out of all the consults that we did, I think that might have been one of the more complicated ones, because, you know, you're working in a healthcare system, one of the big issues that comes up around that is that, is it a healthcare issue? It's definitely a social issue, an issue for government, and you're being called in to address it. But it's not the sort of thing that you normally have to deal with when you're talking about clinical scenarios or organizational scenarios, at least around here anyway. I wanted to ask Duncan about the precautionary principle. That sort of made my ears perk up, because it's very much a kind of a classroom point of discussion, the sort of thing that we teach to our students. So it's interesting to hear that union groups and other groups brought it up. Did they bring it up by name, or was that sort of an interpretation of what they were saying? Because I remember going through some of the decision-making protocols around public health ethics in the early days and thinking, oh, this is very much, very, very much has to do with the precautionary principle, though it was never actually named. But it's interesting that was sort of became like a buzzword in your experience.
Yeah. So it was, as I said, it was really interesting. And just as you said, it's more of a kind of a classroom concept. It's very conceptual, and something we'd expect more in kind of a course on public health ethics or a course on bioethics. So I also was surprised when this came up. And I was also heartened, to be frank. I liked that it came up and that it was an opportunity to kind of dive into this a little, dig into the concept a little, and help people to understand it and bring it to bear in use. It had come up by name, at least with the UNA and the CFNU. And I believe it also came up, if not by name, in some of the College of Physicians and Surgeons work around the pandemic planning. It came up implicitly in some of the conversations. I believe it was explicit. But it was a great opportunity to basically look at how was it coming up in the types of conversations that were happening. And in the conversations, in Alberta, the PPE task force and workplace health and safety were really tightly connected and interacting. I think it was kind of 3 to 5 times a week. It might have been more. It might have been every day early on, with some of the union leaders, really around the principle of ensuring that healthcare workers were properly protected, had the right protections to keep them safe in this context. And the precautionary principle was coming up in terms of how should we interpret different types of evidence that was coming to bear as the kind of blossom of massive amounts of research were being created in the PPE context, in the COVID context, even more broadly. And so it, basically, I'll just to summarize is we did wrote up kind of a four-pager, a fairly quick brief on how to understand how the precautionary principle, well, the precautionary principle within healthcare, and some examples of how it was being used and being brought up in real life in the conversations that were happening with these labor organizations, and then some suggestions on how to interpret it within that context and how to kind of advance forward. You won't be surprised to hear, you three won't be surprised to hear that the suggestion around how to kind of work with the groups in terms of this context was very much kind of boiled down to our normal, what I think is probably all of our normal approaches to organizational issues around kind of making sure that we're on the same page about what we're asking, making sure we descriptively are on the same page about what information we understand and believe to be true, or where there's assumptions we're making or things that we're not sure about, and then what values should be guiding the decision around. In this case, it was broadly PPE decisions, and then using those kind of first three steps to then guide through to making the best decision that lives up to those facts, or reflects those facts and then lives up to those values. I don't know if that tells you everything you wanted to hear, Chris, but that's kind of it at a high level. Yeah.
I was also interested in hearing from Diane about more about the how a lot of these issues became framed disappointingly as individual rights issues, which is something that I definitely saw, you know, south of the border. I kind of wonder whether it's cultural, because I've been very impressed by the Newfoundland Labrador population and the way that there's more of a sort of communal sense about approaching how we handle this pandemic. I mean, we've had our protests, but they've been very small. I mean, today is actually, there's a province-wide mask order that just started today and in all public places, and very, very little pushback, which is great. And I just kind of wonder, like, is it because people, so the framing it as individual rights issues, as individual rights issue, is it because there's just sort of a lack of understanding about the nature of a communicable disease or something? I don't know. Is it a values issue or cultural? What's your sense?
Yeah, I haven't, you know, really, I don't know that I've spoken with anyone directly about why are you protesting this? I mean, it'd be very interesting to go to one of those areas where they're gathered and just have a chat with some folks to try to better understand where they're coming from. I think there's probably a multitude of different, there's probably some information, lack of, information. I think there's another piece around, even if there's information given, it's not trusted. Like they think, well, you said this at the beginning and then you said that now, and there's no sense, and maybe that's an understanding, like, that things have changed over time, but you told us at the beginning we didn't have to wear masks. Now you're telling us to wear masks. Which is right, which is wrong? And when really the situation was evolving, and I think people were trying to make the best decisions at every point along the way. So I think there's a lot of mistrust that's out there of government in general, and what any direction that comes from the government. Well, it's about, I mean, there were a lot of conspiracy theories around, this is not a virus. This was something that was, manufactured to cause chaos in the world. Like there are a lot of, so I think there's multiple factors, maybe lack of information, mistrust, and this whole sense of, you can't tell me what to do. If I want to wear a mask, I'll wear a mask, which is, it's interesting. There probably is a cultural piece. I mean, I think Newfoundland, I'm just thinking about to come from afar, come from away, sort of much more people wrap their arms around each other, perhaps in a way that a place, particularly like big cities like Toronto, not necessarily, you don't know who your neighbors are. You don't know who lives down this, next across the hallway. So you don't have that same maybe connection. I'd be interested in whether others, but that's all just sort of theoretical. I mean, it's just my ponderings. I don't know that they have any, it's not evidence-based ponderings, I guess I'll say.
So I wonder if maybe to close out sort of in a nutshell, you might be able to share what the most significant lesson learned has been for you throughout this experience so far. So maybe we'll reverse again from west to east. So starting with you, Duncan.
Yeah, I would say that One of the things that it underscored for the most very deeply for us is that beyond the kind of the classic ethical values or values and norms that come up within public health, which are the balance between personal liberties and autonomy versus the public good and solidarity, as well as then another one being justice and fairness, which plays a huge role in this context, is trust. Trust and transparency being so critical, sort of more of a procedural value, though it also then leads into providing or respecting folks, is that with issues like the change, the different provinces having different ideas about early on about or interpretations of evidence early on about how to use N95 masks or when those ought to be used and what counted as an aerosol generating medical procedure versus not, and the concerns and ambiguity that created, that really at the end of the day, a lot of the kind of underlying principle in a lot of our responses, maybe all of our responses that we really had to try to live up to, was being transparent and trying to build trust whenever possible, wherever possible.
Thank you. Diane.
I definitely echo that piece about transparency, and the really what I'd add to it is the articulation of the why behind a particular directive or decision to, again, engender that trust. The other thing, lesson I think that we perhaps learned was the importance of the principle of proportionality in the way we respond to pandemics. And in retrospect, it seems fairly evident that we moved too deep, too quickly, was sort of too blunt of an instrument to cancel all non-urgent care in anticipation of a surge that never actually materialized to the degree that we had planned for. And in doing so, we likely caused more harm than was necessary. So I don't think any of us thought we would be able to, you know, empty our hospital by half within a week or two. And so I think next time round, we'll be able to have a much more nuanced response and a much more sort of proportionate response to manage better next time around.
All right, and Chris.
Yeah, I think the most important lesson that I've learned is the importance of, and I sort of understood it before, but the importance of working together. Even though the pandemic is sort of forcing us apart, physical distancing, social distancing, the best work that we've done and the most secure that we've felt is when we've worked together, not just within our teams, our clinical teams and our executive teams, but when we've reached out and found resources from our colleagues across Canada. The Ontario Ethics Table has done some great work. We've really benefited from it. And even just any sort of individual issue that comes up and looking at documents that other centers have provided has been very useful. And so, yeah, as much as the pandemic forces us apart, working together is really what's gotten us through.
I think that's a lovely note to end the conversation on. So thank you all. This was such a rich and thought-provoking discussion. And again, we really appreciate you giving us of your time and your hard-won wisdom around these issues.
Thanks, Marika.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marika. Thanks all. Thanks.